Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of, 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
All right. Well, it looks like John is about to join us in the chat. Oh, well, there. Oh, well, hello, John. What do you have there?
Jason, how embarrassing. You caught me reading this wonderful new book on James Gandolfini by, let's see who the author is. Oh, it's a Jason Bailey. Any relative of yours, perhaps?
He comes up in my Google alerts periodically and is usually being just quite annoying on social media. Okay, let's do a podcast. One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today, gang, is a wonderful film essayist and historian with bylines at Variety, The Times, The Financial Times, The Economist, The Guardian, The Independent, Film School Reject, Sight and Sound, and more. He's also an avid podcaster, hosting the terrific Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema, and you can hear me on one of its 200-ish episodes. He also hosts the Cinema Italia podcast and the James Bond Book Club podcast, and his book, The Magic Hours, The Films and Hidden Life of Terrence Malick, is out now from the University Press of Kentucky, and it is just fantastic. Please welcome Mr. John Bleasdale. Hey, John.
Hey, Jason. Hey, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on, man. It's a pleasure. It's maybe our most geographically spread out episode to date, because I'm in the Eastern time zone, Mike is in the Pacific time zone, and you are in
Central European time zone.
Yes.
I'm in Italy. Yeah.
Very fancy. So yeah, I'm glad we made it happen. But of course we have to, when someone who has done so much tireless promotion and boosting of books about film puts out one of his own. Again, The Magic Hours,
yeah,
is, it's really, really good, man. It's really impeccably researched, thoughtful, insightful, really empathetic. Your love and affection for this filmmaker just burns through on every page. I would imagine that writing a book about a filmmaker who's a huge part of his entire public image is being private and reclusive would present some challenges. Yes, to a book length biographer.
Yeah, it was a quixotic sort of, it was kind of one of the reasons I chose it as well, because the idea was most film directors kind of make extraordinary films, but lead to some degree predictable lives. You know, once they've got to the point that they're making films, then it's all about, you know, what's the next film? And then they release the film and then it receives a certain degree of adulation or criticism, and then they're making another film. And with Malick, there was like this 20-year gap. There's this rush of films, and then so it's all over the shop, and that made it much more interesting as a narrative, as a story to me.
I would imagine so. Well, and also I would think would leave much more room for a kind of a critical analysis, just because so many filmmakers who you know, give interviews, spend so much of that time crafting their persona, doing their own analysis, telling you what to think of their work. And he's done none of that work for you.
Jason, we're here to talk to John about Terrence Malick. Can we stop with the Gandolfini book, please? I mean, I feel like we're having the conversations that you right. and I were having as you were writing that book.
That's
there
true.
There was a lot of like, how do you find the personality of a guy who intentionally hid it?
That's true. You know, I feel that quest quite deeply.
Wait, are we talking about the Elaine May book right now? Or are we talking about again?
Yeah, but I mean, it's true that there are certain filmmakers that I really enjoy and really love reading about. But also, whenever I'm reading about them, I'm also thinking, well, I could just, you know, go on YouTube and watch a 20-minute clip of them talking about themselves, and I would probably get the most articulate version of them. You know, not necessarily David Lynch, but Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, you know, all of these, all of them from that generation, from Malick's generation. So, having someone who didn't do that was actually an advantage.
Yeah. So how exactly then does one go about researching a book on such a private subject?
You make friends with lots of librarians, because librarians are like a secret weapon of anybody who wants to do any research. If you write to a local library and say, I'm trying to find out, because I couldn't find out where he was born. There were like two different birthplaces. Oklahoma and Texas were both given as different birthplaces. And so I wrote to librarians in both places, and they sorted it out for me. They, you know, and they did it all for free. They just said, that's something I can do this afternoon, you know? So I went to Texas, and I visited lots of places. There are photographs in the book, which I sort of went and visited the house he grew up in, and I visited the school that he went to. And I found a lot of people. And the good thing is that the people who are close to Terry, they don't mind talking about him. And there was no no signal came out of the camp saying, don't talk to Bleasdale, he's trouble. So I took that as tacit approval. And people like Jack Fisk, who obviously has a huge, his production designer has a huge role in Days of Heaven, has a huge role in all of his movies up until I think the Song to Song, maybe is his last film. And he wanted to talk to me because he just wanted to fill that gap. He wanted to say, you know, people don't understand what a great guy Terry is. And he wanted to fill the gap that was left by Terry's silence and the sense that, you know, everybody thinks he's this reclusive philosopher.
Yeah, that's fascinating that people wanted to help in that way. That's beautiful. I have found that podcasting has made my books better because it made me a better and frankly just more comfortable interviewer, just getting me past that sort of blockade of intimidation. So I'm curious how you feel that doing your podcast and podcasts has helped you as a writer when you're doing something in a different medium like this.
Yeah, 100%. Totally agree. I think the I never prepare questions for my interviews or for my podcasts because I always find that if I do that, I'm not actually listening to the people. I'm ticking off my questions as I go. And I want a conversation. And often I end up ticking off five or six questions with one answer. And I'm like, oh no, I haven't got enough to give me the rest of the podcast. So it's an anxiety you don't need, I don't feel. So I definitely learned that. Also, the very inception of the book came from a podcast from Patrick McGilligan, who I had on as a guest. And at the end of the podcast, he said, well, why don't you write a book? You know, you're interviewing all these writers. Why aren't you writing one? So he was actually the series editor for Kentucky and said and was quite generous with his time in sort of, you know, getting me through the process. So that was great. And he's just come out with a wonderful book. I've just had him on again as a guest for his Woody Allen biography, which is, you know, I mean, my God, the courage of the man. you know, to do a 700 page book on Woody Allen in this economy.
Yes. Well, that is awesome. Well, I'm so glad that he gave you that push, because it's a terrific book, and one you should be quite proud of. And frankly, something I'm glad exists in the world of scholarship around this really special filmmaker. So what film did you select to discuss with us today?
Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven.
In 1916, America was changing.
God, they're just right up front with the beauty shots in this trailer. They're like, hey, you want to see one of the most gorgeous movies ever made? Here you go.
Well, to be fair, they were limited to beautiful shots to choose from. So,
that's true. That's very true.
Yeah, I don't know if there was any bad stuff to pick.
Yeah, couldn't have quite buried the lead, I guess.
And so they came.
And that wonderful Ennio Morricone score as well.
Yeah. Oh.
Blindly searching for the days of heaven.
Hey, that's the title.
The Empire, it's striking back.
Days of heaven. The story of a man who had nothing.
The woman who loved him. We're more than halfway in it. Will there be any actual dialogue from the film? Oh, there it is.
And the man who would give her Brief everything for a share of that love.
You know what I thought when I first saw you? I thought if only I could touch her, that everything'd be all right.
Three people whose destinies joined briefly in a dream. But how long could it last? The Days of Heaven.
Interesting choice to add a V into the title there, Mr. Paramount voiceover narrator. So Days of Heaven was the second feature film written and directed by Mr. Terrence Malick, subject of John's book, following Badlands. He wrote the leading role for John Travolta, who wanted very badly to make the film, but was unable to free himself of his commitment to welcome back Cotter. Unexpected intersection there. So Malick cast a then all but unknown Richard Gere. It was a tricky shoot due to the unconventional methodology of the young director and his cinematographer, Nestor Almendros. He would spend over a year in the editing room, tinkering with his images, reducing dialogue, and adding unscripted, initially voiceover narration by Linda Manns. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Days of Heaven in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says...
Terrence Malick's follow-up to Badlands is set in 1915. Richard Gere, his girlfriend Brooke Adams, who for no good reason other than the convenience of the story pretends to be his sister, and his streetwise 12-year-old real sister Linda Manns, who narrates the picture, become migrant workers. They take a job harvesting wheat for wealthy bachelor farmer Sam Shepard, his acting debut, who falls for Adams. Learning that Shepard has only a year left to live, Gere convinces Adams to marry him and become a rich widow. After the wedding, the four share Shepard's elegant, soulless house. But two things happen. Adams falls in love with Shepard. Shepard begins to suspect that there's something strange about the relationship between this brother and sister. This is the rare film in which all the adult characters are sympathetic. Even though they commit unsavory acts, that Gere and Adams would exploit nice guy Shepard is okay with us because Shepard pays the migrant workers lousy wages for backbreaking work and has a dictatorial overseer, Robert Wilkie, who earlier laid down the unfair law for Gere and Adams. Sordid Tale is given a beauty treatment by cinematographer Nestor Almendros and Haskell Wexler that would seem fitting for a big budget epic. The photography is absolutely gorgeous. Filming was done in Canada. In fact, the breathtaking shots of people and landscape, particularly the sun-drenched wheat fields, almost make us forgive the underdeveloped characters and slim storyline.
Oh, here
Danny
he goes.
Perry
All
coming
right.
in with
here
the knife.
He goes.
Coming
here
in
he
with
goes.
The knife under the ribs.
Yeah. There you
but
go.
But this is art for art's sake. Don't say he's stupid. But this is art for art's sake. Too slow and studied for the impatient. When the film finally becomes lively and exciting toward the end, Malick spoils it with a thoroughly depressing ending. No wonder his films don't make any money. The slow drawl, too wise, and too poetic narration by Mann seems phony, as if she were reading it. Art direction by Jack Fisk, also with Jackie Schultes and Stuart Margolin. I gotta say, like, I agree with several of his criticisms, but there's nothing that man's actor, there's nothing she can do that's wrong for me. Time we see her, every time she talks, every gesture, every, like, for me, she wins every time, including in the narration.
Right. And as we will discuss, as if she were reading it may be the most incorrect assumption in the entirety of Guide for the Film Fanatic. But that's fine.
And like, well, she's like one of those, like those, like we talk about this, like there are certain actors that just could only visually be present in movies in the 70s. And she's one of them. She's just sort of weird looking. I don't, it's not positive, negative, whatever. She just doesn't have the sort of perfect face that you've had to have for Hollywood for a long time now. And I'm just drawn in by her immediately.
Well, I am too. And also, and by the fact that, like, you know, I think wonderfully uses those archival photos, or what I assume are archival photos, those sort of Dust Bowl, you know, let us, you know, what's the title of the thing? The James Agee thing. Let us now praise famous men. They look like the photos that accompany that essay. So it really situates this story within sort of history and myth, but like when the last photo is of her face, it 100% seems like it's one of those. Like it's her face is both, I see what you're saying, Mike, of the 70s, and also incredibly like Dust Bowl archival photograph. But John, let's start with, I'm very curious to hear your personal history in not just with this film, but sort of with Malick in general. When did you come to him? Where did this fall in your education of his work? All that sort of context is of interest.
I first came to Malick via a TV show on BBC Two, which is the second of the major channels when I was growing up. It was called Movie Drome. It was presented by Alex Cox, the director of Walker and Sid and Nancy others. And he presented these cult films, and he presented Badlands. And in the intro, he said, you know, nobody knows where this film director is, and he made two wonderful films. So that was the first time I'd even heard of Days of Heaven. And then like a few years later, I saw Days of Heaven again on television, and it was like a Channel 4 season on great films of cinematography. And so it was like literally presented as sort of, this is one of the most beautiful films ever. Look at the cinematography. And I just thought, I mean, I was impressed by the cinematography and I thought it was beautiful and everything, but I just thought the film was heartbreaking in so many ways. And it really touched me emotionally. And I feel the same thing about Badlands. And I think sometimes one of the things Terrence Malick gets hit with is that he's somehow, you know, an intellectual director, an arty director, and it doesn't touch people. And I've always found that a very strange, it's just not been my experience. And of course, then there was I saw both these films early 90s, I think maybe even the late 80s for Badlands. I had the weight of waiting for Thin Red Line and the anticipation of Thin Red Line. I went to see it in Liverpool when it came out, and lo and behold, Alex Cox was sitting right in front of me in the the cinema. And as we came out of the cinema, he was I was earwigging on what he was saying. I was eavesdropping, and he was saying to the person he was with, his friend, he was saying, "Oh, what the heck were those haircuts about? You know, what's Sean Penn, rocking that rockabilly haircut? What year was this supposed to be?" And I wanted to say, "Man, you had helicopters in Walker, and that was meant to be like the turn of the 90s. Yeah, what are you talking about?
There's a PC on the desk of Walker.
Exactly. Ed Harris is. Funnily enough, I had to email him for the project for the biography. Well, I wanted to, because he mentioned that he'd seen Lantern Mills. So I wanted to gather as many people who'd seen Lantern Mills as possible. That's the short film that Malick made before Badlands when he was in, not university, what's it called? The American Film Institute Greystone, the conservatory in Los Angeles. Right. And he was and I mentioned this thing about, oh, by the way, I was watching Badlands, Thin Red Line behind you, and I mentioned the haircuts, and he said, yeah, I remember I had a thing about haircuts in those days. So he remembered that reaction. That was kind of, and he was very useful. So you very much, Alex Cox.
That's great. I guess now that you say it, I have heard that idea floated around as a criticism for, and I can't even wrap my brain around it. Like, I feel like his films are pure emotion just because there's so much more about mood and vibes and tone than they are about story and narrative, or even really vast, grand intellectual ideas. They seem very much to me to be rooted in feeling. And so much of this movie is just about the feeling of being in the company of these people and sort of the feelings of love or jealousy or whatever they might be that are sort of emanating off of them. No?
Yeah, I don't think Peary's criticism of the characters as being sort of shallow. I don't think they're shallow. I just think they're young. Mm. I think that, this is about people who have not quite formed themselves, and they're living hand to mouth. They're running from one thing to the other, literally running to catch trains, and they're, and the whole thing about them, pretending to be brother and sister, that sort of goes with the biblical feel of the right. film. Abraham would frequently right. pretend to be brother and sister, and likewise the Bible can be criticized for unmotivated tricks and things, so that's not necessarily a Get Out, but
just throwing wild shit at the wall in the writer's room of the Bible. Yeah.
Exactly. But I just find, like, Richard Gere, Brooke Adams, Linda Manz and Sam Shepard, I just find them all really convincing. I find their characters really sad and tragic. And it's mm-hmm. a tragedy. And here I definitely agree with Dan. It's a tragedy in which everyone's right. Everybody has got a reason for doing what they're doing. There's no obvious bad person. Right. And there's even a scene late on where Richard right. Gere comes back and he says to Brooke Adams, it was my own fault. I didn't know what I had. I pushed you towards him. He doesn't say, oh yeah, you're enjoying yourself now. You're living, high on the hog, and you should come back to me. It doesn't run the conventional way. And so the irony is so tragic when Sam Shepard's farmer sees that and sees it for what it isn't. He thinks it's a continuation of something. Right. It's in fact the end,
Yeah. No, I love it. So many moments like the storytelling throughout is just so offhand. Like, it's so, he's the idea of obvious emotional beats of on the nose expositional dialogue, like, all he's anemic to all of that. Like, he's uninterested in any of those ideas. What struck me for the first time totally by accident about the narrative was, I rewatched this a few days ago to prepare for this. Over the weekend, one of the nerdiest things that I do is I sometimes when I'm just like doing dishes or housework, I have old Siskel and Ebert episodes on my Plex. I'm sort of like walking through film history with Siskel and Ebert. Came on a Fall 97 episode where they reviewed The Wings of the Dove. And I it had never occurred to me before that this is basically like a rewrite of the broad stroke narrative of Wings of the Dove. But it's so casual that you don't even catch that much of a sort of highfalutin literary reference, I guess.
He does that a lot with even right up until these later films, that he'll use Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and there'll be there's loads of literature in Thin Red Line. He has Stephen Crane, and obviously it's itself a literary adaptation. And just today I was reading, aside from the wonderful Gandolfini biography, I was reading The Brothers Karamazov, and there's a line in that where the elder says, if you don't love, then your life will flip by. And I thought, wait a minute, that's Jessica Chastain's line from Tree of Life,
Yeah.
And it's word for word. And you just think, Mike, okay, that's just something he's picked out.
Steal from the best.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. you know? Yeah. And so I get that with Days of Heaven. It feels like a very rich literary text. And one of the reasons I think it has this criticism of people saying, you know, oh, the characters aren't XYZ, or is that it's a film where he doesn't use scenes. You know, he wrote a script which has scenes in it and all the rest of it, but he pares it down. He cuts out all the lines. And so where you usually have scenes, you just get one line or two lines or a montage or, you know. And I talked to Brooke Adams about this, and she hadn't talked about the film for a little while. I think she might. Did you talk to her at some point, Jason? Did you have somebody. I think somebody did a Q&A with her like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but she hadn't talked for ages apart from that. And she said she was kind of, whenever they had a problem as actors, he would say, oh, forget it, lose that line. Or if he just wasn't happy with the line, just lose it, just do it without that line. And he got to the point where they were worried it was going to be a silent movie because they, you know, and they would be saying, no, I can do it better. And it was like, no, I don't want it. Leave it out. So in the end, he ended up getting back to, you know, Los Angeles with reels and reels of film and kind of no dialogue. You talk about there not being much dialogue in the trailers, not much dialogue in the film.
There's not. No, and that's very striking that it, at the same time that it has all of this, you know, falls within these literary traditions, it also there are scenes where it, even before I read the chapter in the book after rewatching the movie, but even as I was rewatching it, I was like, there are silent movie scenes in this, and these like from the jump, like the first dialogue scene, the argument between Gear and the boss, we don't hear it. We don't hear any of what they're saying, but he knows we don't need it. Like, he knows that he can show the conflict and the specifics of it don't matter. You know, throughout there are little scenes where you're right, where there's it's a line or two. If that last scene between Adams and Mans, they say so little in that scene, but yet there's never any doubt of what's happening intellectually or emotionally between any of these people at any given point.
There's a real sense that he already had it in his head what everything was doing. And so when he took it out, he still knew that the bones, because even though if you read the screenplay, which I think is available on the internet, if you read the screenplay, it isn't that different from the film. And the same is true of like all of the screenplays that have leaked onto the internet. If you even the Tree of Life screenplay, you can see it has a very you can see where the film has come from, even though, you know, obviously there's a lot in the Tree of Life which has changed. So I think this story has that. I mean, like when you talk about the prologue and him having the fight in the factory and this sort of industrial noise, which is very much like a David Lynch film, you know. You don't even know if Richard Gere's killed the guy. You know, he just hits him and it doesn't look good. But, I mean, you think murder would be something that a film would normally, you know, present in an unambiguous
clarify
fashion. Yeah, exactly. It's like he definitely killed him or he didn't, you know.
But then all these, you know, these silent movie techniques are then offset by the voiceover narration, which is so... It's like it's somehow both lyrical and vernacular. What I put down in my notes was equal parts Whitman and Bowery Boys. And I found the material in the book about how that narration came to be really fascinating. So tell the listeners who haven't had a chance to read, when people think about this movie, that's one of the first things they think about is that narration. So I was shocked by how late in the game it came into play and the methodology by which it did.
Well, I mean, it's an ironic thing that, you know, Malick is known for his voiceovers. I once did a sort of parody website for like The Onion for film news. And one of my headlines was Terrence Malick's caught a cold and lost his voiceovers. But it's become a sort of cliche with him. But when he wrote the script for Days of Heaven, there wasn't a voiceover and he had no intention of putting one. He thought he'd already done it. And it was very much a 11th hour decision to do it. Partly because, so for instance, taking out a lot of the lines, part of that was he didn't like Sam Shepard's performance. He thought, Sam Shepard, this is his first film. It's Richard Gere's, practically his first film. And Brooke Adams had some experience in soap operas and things. And I think she had a bit role in a car wash or something. But she's, this again is for a first major role. So he had really, really young actors who were not experienced. And I don't think he was happy with their performances, which is crazy because I think they're wonderful in the film. But we don't see what, you know, we don't see what ended up on the cutting room floor.
Right.
When he put it together, and there's a lot, by the way, when you see in the trailer as well, though, any shots that you see against the sky of Sam Shepard, those are mostly Los Angeles. Those are mostly things that are shot about a year later when they get back to Los Angeles because they can't fit stuff together. They can't tell the story with what they've got. They've got wonderful sort of nature shots and all that sort of stuff, all the stuff by the house, the fire, all the big set pieces are there, but they need some linking material. So they decide to do the voiceover. He writes voiceovers and he thinks he'll do diary entries and he'll do, or he'll do letters or he'll do something like that to make it sort of firmly place it in a literary tradition. None of this works out. And he tries it with different actors. You know, Brooke Adams reads a few, Richard Gere reads a few, and it's not working. So he gets Linda Manz over, and because she's a minor, she has to be chaperoned. And she's staying in this hotel room with this woman who's like a family member of the crew. And she's a Christian, and she's telling them the story of the revelation. And when it's basically the last day before she flies back to New York, she goes round to Terry's studio to record. I think it's a hotel room that he's using with a sort of tape deck to record this voiceover. And he's written stuff out for her. And she says, "Oh, I want to tell you this story that Janine told me last night. It's about the end of the world. Have you heard about it? What's going to happen at the end of the world? Everyone's going to be flying around and on fire and all this." And he's like, "I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear. We haven't got time for this." And then she insists, you know, and he listens to her and he just goes, "Okay, wait a second," you know, clunk, click, and he turns on the recorder and says, "Say that again." And essentially that thing, you know, I met this guy called Ding Dong and he told me about the end of the world and everything. You can listen to the quality of the tape in the film, and it's very obviously a tape recording because that's the original narration that he's got. So it's not written, it's her remembering stuff. So for the rest of the narration, he would write some. Jacob Brackman, who was his close friend, Carly Simon's songwriter, would write some. He would, and other bits, he would just show her the scene and say, "What's happening here?" And she would say, you know, "Chill up the farmer," you know, and that would be, that's her explaining what happens, you know, and he would put that in, you know, she loved the farmer. That's what happened, you know, and that became,
that's how fucking,
you know,
art gets made by accident.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
All the planning you have to do to make all of these shots. How do you get all these fucking grasshoppers out here? All this shit. Like, I mean, there's so much work to get all of that done. How do you film all this fire without lighting the world up? Right. I mean, there's so much work. But the thing that ties it all together is an accident in a hotel room because a little kid couldn't stop and fucking concentrate on what we were all here to do. Right. Couldn't stop and pay attention to the job that all the professionals are here for. And so the kid keeps fucking interrupting, and now all of a sudden you have real art. I mean, that's like, you can't buy that shit. You can't plan for it. You know what I mean? You just have to anyway, that's such a beautiful story. I'd never heard that before, but it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
I mean, you could argue as well that the rest of his entire career is an attempt to replicate those conditions. So any criticism that you might have of some of his later films where you think, "Oh, come on, why doesn't he block people properly on Night of Cups? Why are people wandering around aimlessly in Song to Song?" Well, it's because he's desperately trying to catch that lightning one more time. And he's, you know, it's very difficult to do. And personally, I'd rather see him experiment and get... You know, he's got a very good batting average in my book, but try at least to make that sort of film than to make, you know, 20 very competent melodramas, which is, you know, which otherwise you could right. probably do.
Mike, you had one other question about the production that I thought John would enjoy explaining for you.
Oh, I just, you know, you're watching the movie, you know, and credits are rolling by, and like, it's easy to forget that somehow Haskell Wexler is the additional photographer. I mean, we were talking about what movie we were talking about a couple of weeks ago where Steinbeck came in to rewrite Hemingway for this script. It's like, how the fuck is Haskell Wexler your backup guy? That's just insane. And the movie's so beautiful. Like, obviously, you know, your main guy, it knows what he's doing, but it just, that credit just seemed so weird.
Well, there were three cinematographers on the film, and one of them was Nesta Armendaros, who was François Truffaut's cinematographer, and he was very much Terry very much wanted him because he had done The Wild Child with Truffaut, and he wanted that sort of luck, and he wanted this idea of someone who could sort of create a very some people inside nature rather than, you know, using nature as a background, but really foreground it. And he also had another guy who was basically, I forget his name now, I won't be able to remember his name, but he was basically given a list of shots and second unit shots and basically sent off to Montana to just shoot, you know, literally, you know, I want wind rippling on pond, I want lightning in the distance. Jason, have you found it in the...
Paul Ryan?
Paul Ryan, yes. That's him. Yeah,
Paul
yeah, yeah.
Ryan, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and he did all these.
Not the future shitty Speaker of the House. No, different no, Paul Ryan. No. Everybody.
And he was given a long shot list and sent off, and a lot of those shots, you know, lightning in the distance. A lot of those shots are in the film, and so he was a big sort of like unsung mm-hmm. hero. And again, Terry kind of does that with all his films. He's always got a team of people running out and doing his bidding, and with very detailed instructions on how they should be shot, what they should look like, what the movement of the camera should be, and all that sort of stuff. And he gets tons of it and then selects very little. I mean, Voyage of Time, he barely touches a camera himself for that, and it's almost all delegated to people going running off doing that. And then you have Nesta, and then you have but Nesta had a hard out. He had to go and do a Truffaut film. So when the film went over time, he had to leave. And the brothers who were the Schneider brothers, Harold and Bert, who were financing it, and they were personally up for the, if there were overages, they were going to lose their houses. They knew Wexler, and they said, you go in there and you do some quick, you know, we want to speed up the situation. But he basically had to match Nesta's all of the stuff Nesta had shot. So he was basically copying his style and following his rules, which were all about natural light and don't put any electricity up. And the electricians were, you know, I talked to Brooke Adams, and she said the electricians were just off smoking pot and everything because they just didn't have anything to do on the shoot whatsoever. There was no lighting. There was very, very little light. and they would just...
Can you set up some spots over lunch?
Yeah. I mean they do that on The New World as well. They would have a full crew sort of hanging around while Terry went off with like Emmanuel Lubezki into the, you know, and two actors, and they just went into the grass and just shot stuff without anybody. And and when Nesta won the Oscar for the film, Wexler was kind of a little bit pissed off, and he said that he'd gone in and he'd basically watched it in the theater with a stopwatch and basically noted down how many shots were his, how many were Nesta's. And he worked out that it was about 50-50, and maybe he even had the advantage, and why didn't he share the Oscar? And I think it was Roger Ebert said to him, oh, come on, you know, you've already got one, and you know, you shouldn't. And also, you'd followed someone else's style. You hadn't, you know, you weren't responsible for choosing how right. this was being shot. You were following it. Plus, the chances are actually that wasn't really true because there's this other cinematographer. So there's probably, you know, it even shares out even more than just the two of them. I think the real answer comes in Nestor's speech when he collected the Oscar, and he said every image on that screen is Terry Malick's. And Malick had not even been nominated. I don't think he'd even been nominated as director, had he? But it was just like,
I don't believe so.
As far as he was concerned, the Malick's father's a photographer, was a photographer. And Malick was the most sort of knowledgeable about photography of you know, people like Lubetzky, who, let's face it, is no, you know, he's okay as a cinematographer, right? Chivo. he's made a few films, yeah, you know. He's made, yeah. And he absolutely
he's got a pretty good idea.
Yeah, exactly. So he absolutely buys in with Malick on his cinematography.
Offer valid on standard browsers, US only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. Datemyage.com.
The ideas, and you don't get The Revenant without The New World, for instance. You know, he's absolutely sold on. And you don't get The New World without Days of Heaven. So the influence just flows and flows. Yeah.
No, it is. It's a beautiful movie. It's a fascinating production. Again, the entire book of The Magic Hours is terrific, but this chapter especially is really just a really well-researched, well-written peek into what could have been a disaster and somehow resulted in this beautiful work of art. Okay, let's take a quick break, and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception. Friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Days of Heaven, which opened in New York on September 13th, 1978. Also in theaters that weekend, Robert Altman's A Wedding, Claudia Weill's Girlfriends, Monty Hellman's China 9 Liberty 37, Joe Dante's Piranha, Woody Allen's Interiors, Irvin Kershner's The Eyes of Laura Mars, and last but certainly not least, Jim Clark's Debbie Does Dallas. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
You suppose anybody was running a Days of Heaven, Debbie Does Dallas double feature?
There's a lot of beauty in the world, and that's two different ways to see it.
September 13, 1978, there was a newspaper strike going down in New York City, so we don't have a convenient scan of the paper of record to pull from. So instead, we're going to talk about strikes, because I don't think anybody working these days even knows what they are anymore. So to quote Jimmy Hoffa, So 30 minutes later. Also, on September 13th, the Ford Motor Company becomes the first corporation in U.S. history to be indicted on criminal charges when a grand jury agreed they should be charged with reckless homicide and criminal negligence for the deaths of three girls who were caught in a fire when a Pinto exploded on August 10th. A major American corporation being held responsible for their actions. Can you believe it?
You know, I like this idea of bringing back indicting car companies on criminal charges. I have a suggestion for one, in fact, that we could mill about. Yeah.
They haven't sold enough Cybertrucks for it to matter. And finally, September 13th was the first test of Project Excalibur, an attempt by the Lawrence Livermore National Library to develop orbital lasers to shoot down nuclear weapons. I know, Reagan, look, this is 70, Eight, right? 78?
Yeah.
I know Reagan gets a lot of guff for his Star Wars boondoggle, but this idea was failing long before he got there. All right?
That's very true.
All right? Mm-hmm. And it gave Teller at least one ulcer. It was good for that. Who knew? Jason, what did the critics have to say about Days of Heaven?
Well, because of the aforementioned newspaper strike, our pal Mr. Canby did not write a full-length review of Days of Heaven, but he included it in his year-end top 10 list, writing, quote, "Mr. Malick works so obliquely that it's often difficult to see what he's up to. Since his films are so visually stunning, one is tempted to think he's interested in superficial prettiness. Far from it. Among other things, Days of Heaven is about human isolation in a universe that is neither friendly nor unfriendly, merely indifferent to the transients who, like the characters in this film, spend their lives trying to cope, sometimes with grace."
Obliquely. Roger, what an interesting word to describe Malick as a director. That's a really good word.
Roger Ebert, covering the film in his The Great Movie series in 1997, wrote, "Days of Heaven is above all one of the most beautiful films ever made. Malick's purpose is not to tell a story of melodrama, but one of loss. His tone is elegiac. He evokes the loneliness and beauty of the limitless Texas prairie." He also wrote, "This is a movie made by a man who knew how something felt and found a way to evoke it in us. That feeling is how a child feels when it lives precariously and then is delivered into security and joy and then has it all taken away again and blinks away the tears and says it doesn't hurt."
Oof.
Good line, Roger Ebert. Variety called it a dramatically moving and technically breathtaking American art film, one of the great cinematic achievements of the 1970s. Told in 95 minutes, it is an efficient, meaningful story filled with some offbeat touches, literary references, and beautifully developed characters. End quote. Our friend Pauline Kael, however, was not a fan, writing, "It's both a nostalgic and an anti-nostalgic vision of the American past. The landscapes are vast and lonely, with the space in the images strained and the figures tilted. The characters are monosyllabic, near mute. What is unspoken in this picture weighs heavily on us, but we're not quite sure what it is. The film is an empty Christmas tree. You can hang all your dumb metaphors on it." Which is not accurate, but is, credit where due, a very good line.
I mean, I
it's a good line.
If you, I think that can be, I think that is a real, I think that is a real way to see this movie. If you're not sort of invested in it, if I don't like Richard Gere and I keep fucking trying and I keep not liking him and buying him as like a working class fucking guy who's having a hard time, like, no, that's nonsense. And it's when he's good when he's like, I mean, he's great in Pretty Woman. He's a soulless fucking rich guy. He seems very, very capable of playing that part. Right? I mean, so like, I think that you can, and this watching it this time, I enjoyed it more this time than I have ever before. I think it was really leaning into the man's character. And Brooke Adams is fantastic. I paid more attention to Sam Shepard than ever before this time. And I'm shocked to hear that he thought he didn't do a good job, because that guy conveys, like, I don't know, almost all of the human emotions with almost no dialogue. I mean, I think he is very, very good in this movie. Yeah. Like, I enjoyed this movie a lot more this time than I have any other time that I've seen it. And I think that, like, unless you can find yourself sort of invested in this whole, because it's also a completely different universe than most of us are living in, you know. And I imagine she went once, watched it once, was waiting to get to the fucking diner,
always
maybe have had a date that night. I don't know. It's that to me feels like a review of somebody who was not really paying that much attention, who was not really that invested. And I think that's okay, in the way that Perry says, like, it does not reward the impatient, right?
Yes.
And I think that that's like, Pauline Kael has always, to me, felt like nothing if not an impatient person. She's
correct.
A proper New Yorker. She is impatient. Agreed. And she's not, she doesn't have fucking time to wait on Terrence Malick's Oklahoma ass to get around to fucking lighting all the grasshoppers on fire, right? I don't think that that's like I don't think that she's ignoring it. I think that is an approach to it, because I have felt the same.
Sure. Here's
I didn't
my follow-up
this time.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my follow-up question, Mike. Would you have enjoyed it more or less with John Travolta in the leading role?
Dramatically less. I think that's fucking ridiculous. I think that whole concept is insane. Now, that might be because he never had a chance to be that guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things where, like, I mean, did Travolta play that part? Like did he ever play that role in anything?
There's not a million miles between this and what he's doing in Blowout. I'm very serious that the emotionally stunted quality of that character is not a million miles removed from this. I firmly believe.
Well, I also like this being in the Cotter time. And I mean, like you can, the link between the Cotter character and Saturday Night Fever is like, is a very, very, that's a very small puddle to walk over. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so that also might be the problem here might be the limitation of my imagination. And Travolta and Terrence Malick actually had a grander imagination than envisioned something like that. It's very hard for me. Whereas this is a thing that Richard Gere tried to do for most of his career and just failed at mostly, in my opinion. See, when you take words out of his mouth, it makes the movie better. The Terrence Malick was very smart.
How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
It cost $3 million and grossed $3.4 million. So not exactly a blockbuster, but you know what? You don't make Malick movies to get rich. It's fucking art. Remember, like we said.
That's right.
Paramount, which financed and released the picture, was so happy with the final result that Gulf and Western head Charles Bludorn offered Malick $1 million up front for whatever movie he wanted to make next. Sweet. John, how long did Mr. Malick take to make his next movie?
20 years. never offer someone $1 million to make. Well, I mean, nowadays $1 million wouldn't exact, but the blank check is not the artist's friend.
And by the way, did not make that movie for Paramount. If I'm not mistaken, never made another Paramount picture.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, he weirdly did make that picture in the end. He actually shot stuff which was used in Tree of Life and Voyage of Time. So there was material from that project. Just going back to your Richard Gere thing, when Richard Gere showed up to the shoot, first thing he did was refuse to get his hair cut for the period.
Right.
And so he has like disco hair for the whole film. And,
Alex Cox must have been furious.
Absolutely. But I think Terry got his revenge because when, spoiler, Gere's character dies, is shot and goes into the water, the way they got that brilliant shot is my favorite shot of the movie, which is of his face entering the water. It sort of spread, the bubbles spread and create a like death mask. It was by dunking his head in Sissy Spacek's aquarium. And that sounds like a euphemism, but I'm the camera's underneath and they're just splashing his head in there to get that shot. And I thought that's like one of those magical shots.
He did a lot of takes of that, didn't he?
Yeah, it's like, nah, do it again with his long hair, with your uncut hair.
Nice haircut, Rich. I love it. Yeah. Nice hair, Richard. Oh, my God. Days of Heaven was up for 4 Academy Awards, Best Sound, Best Costume, Best Original Score for the great Ennio Morricone and Nestor Almendros for Best Cinematography. Only the last of those won, kind of undeniable, really. More importantly, at the 1979 Cannes Film Festival, where it was up for the Palme d'Or, Malick won the award for Best Director, the first time an American had won that prize since 1955. I did not know he was from Texas. That is genuine. Yeah. I don't know where I thought he was from, but like...
He was like not of this earth?
Right. Like he just sort of came in a meteor, you know, and was fully formed.
Yeah.
I don't know, but
like Kal-El or something. Yeah.
It makes everything make more sense. Actually, the idea that he was from the prairie.
There we go. All right. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. John, you're our guest, which means you go first.
I would double this up with John Sayles' Matawan.
Ooh, good pick. Yes. Why do you think those would pair nicely?
Well, one of the reasons is I think one of the things that never gets talked about with Terrence Malick is how political a filmmaker he is. Everybody's always on the beauty and the philosophy and the religion as we get further on. But I think he's just as interested in, even in terms of religion, I think he's interested in ethics as it relates to broader societal issues. So you have Badlands, you have serial killing and the media and law and order. Days of Heaven, you have, you know, brutal labor relationships and massive inequality and how that deals. Thin Red Line as well is all about, you know, people murdering for their government and murdering, you know, in the form of war. And he actually questions that in a very straightforward way that I think people go, oh, it's so philosophical. Well, having someone say, should we be killing each other or not? How is that? So, right. You know, it's not exactly, you know, it's not exactly that oblique to borrow a term. It's pretty on the nose. Your Hidden Life, you know, I think I don't think it was timed that you could say it was like a film about Trump, but it was a film about Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was conceived prior to that. But if you watch that film as a Trump era film, it's all about a good man who refuses to submit to his government's immoral actions. And Matawan is a film that I watched much about around about the same time I first discovered Malick. I've always loved John Sayles as a film director. I think he's a phenomenal and I hesitate to say underrated because that's always used of people who are really, really rated. Ingmar Bergman, he's so underrated. Akira Kurosawa is so underrated. It usually means I've just discovered him, you know.
yes.
Chris Cooper, there's a James Earl Jones. So much that is wonderful about this film, and it's about this horrible sort of strike and these brutal conditions under which the people are searching and fighting for some sort of equity and representation and power. And yet it does it in a really humane way. And there's a scene of music where different groups with different ethnic sort of origins of different immigrant groups start to play music, and they sort of start to play it almost together. And you get this, you know, mixing of musical genres around a campfire. And me saying it sounds very, very sort of corny, but it really isn't. And it reminds me, there's a scene in Days of Heaven as well where there's music played and you have this sort of like Louisiana sort of bluesy country music being played, and it's and also the workers are sort of tap dancing and doing various things, and there's just this sense of, wow, there's a real culture going on here that is invisible and will sort of merge with the mainstream and just disappear, and we won't know where it came from. And I like both these films, you know. I think they would chime very well in that way.
I agree. Yeah, I saw that one for the first time just a few years ago, whenever the Criterion edition came out, and it just hit me like a thunderbolt. That is a great, and I still think, even though it's in the Criterion collection, an unsung American masterpiece of that era. My pick, I went with another Malick movie, but one that that is perhaps his least seen, because he didn't direct it, he just co-wrote it. This is 1974's The Dion Brothers, aka The Gravy Train, which is a script that he wrote with Bill Kirby. It was directed by Jack Starrett. I'm not sure how to say the director's name. Stacey Keach is in it, Frederick Forrest, Margot Kidder, and it is basically, you know, he made this, this came out between Badlands and Days of Heaven. It is more in the tradition of Badlands, just in terms that it's sort of a fugitives on the run sort of thing, but it is basically a comedy. It's sort of an action comedy, neither of which are genres that we really immediately associate with Mr. Malick, and who is a filmmaker we tend to think of as being very high-minded and intellectual and super duper serious. And there's this notion that he is this super serious guy with no comic sense. And when you watch the Dion brothers, you understand immediately. No, he had a very keen sense of comedy, of comic timing. It's a fun movie. It's a funny movie. It's got a great energy to it. The performers are terrific. And really, you know, it's early enough on. It was not a hit. It's early enough on that you feel like if it had been, who knows if that, you know, if the career might have gone in a different direction, or at least there would have been more work along those lines. It's a hard movie to see. There are not like official releases out there. You have to kind of poke around to find it. But in my humble opinion, at least, it is worth the effort. Mike, what is your pick?
Man, this whole cinematographer thing really fucked me up. So I started looking around trying to figure out what exactly happened here. And I didn't really get nearly as much useful detail as I got once we actually started talking. But the thing I did get was I started looking around at other Nestor Almendros films, because like I wasn't really, was not a name that necessarily jumped out to me in terms of somebody that I could just place a bunch of his other work. But meanwhile, he shot Days of Fucking Heaven, at least part of it, you know, won an Academy Award for it. It was just like one of those things where it's like, well, this seems like very low-hanging fruit in terms of finding something useful. So I started looking at his other movies, and I was reminded of the Romer film Pauline at the Beach, which he also shot. And so I started watching Pauline at the Beach again, and you know, it's a fun film. It's an interesting film. It's boring until it's not. And when it's not, you're all of a sudden just like, whoa, well, this could go. Mm-hmm. This just went left in a fucking very interesting way. The whole thing with the.
Yeah.
It's a weird, like, it's one of those movies where, like, a sort of mistaken identity thing feels consequential, where, like, teen love feels consequential. Mm-hmm. Sort of in a very weird, sort of unexpected way. Not my normal sort of movie. But I'm picking it now because he also filmed it, and it is could not be more different in terms of everything about it than Days of Heaven. It's French people who are not necessarily sophisticated, but like super sophisticated relative to these fucking Dust Bowl, you know, hillbillies, even with their disco hair, right? But also, it's not, you know, I mean, Days of Heaven, like, until you go in the house, and we don't spend hardly any time in the house. It's all big sky country everywhere you go, you know? And Pauline at the Beach is, like, there's sort of inexplicable, like, 12-minute scenes and little rooms where they're, like, looking out windows and stuff, and, like, people, like, sort of walking along the beach. It's just a much more contained, just a dramatically more contained film visually. And it's way more about the people and their sort of interactions. And just watching it sort of back to back, just almost as a visual study with Days to Heaven, was just such a weird and interesting. I mean, it just couldn't be more different. Like, unless he was going to go shoot fucking Star Wars or something, he couldn't have found a more different sort of aesthetic and universe.
Yeah.
And just story type to film in. So I would just say, like, you know, yeah, Pauline at the Beach. It's a good movie for several reasons, but just visually relative to Days of Heaven is a very weird and different film.
For the record, I would 100% have watched Nestor's Star Wars.
Hell yeah, John, bro. Hell yeah.
The book, again, is The Magic Hours, the films and hidden life of Terrence
Malick. No, he should have shot Dune.
Right.
The Dune was the obvious. He should have shot Dune. There you go. All right. Sorry. Go
there
ahead.
There you go. Writers on Film and the James Bond Book Club have new episodes regularly. Where can people follow you on social media, sir?
I'm over on Blue Sky, and I think it's just my name. I think it's www.johnbleasdale.com.
There you go.
At Dr. John T. At Instagram.
Got it. I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Instagram and Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, please do leave us a kind rating, review, etc. on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. Quick reminder that my book, Gandolfini, Jim Tony and the Life of a Legend, is out now wherever you find hardbacks and ebooks and audiobooks. Thank you, John. And also, if you're one of those oddballs who likes to watch videos of people recording recording a podcast and doing various wacky bits with books. You can find us on YouTube, where our channel is Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who has a big spread and a lot of money. Whoever was sitting in a chair when he'd come around, why, they'd stand up and give it to him.
Thank you again, John.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us next week for David Lynch's Dune with special guest Max Avery, author of The Dune Oral History, A Masterpiece in Disarray. All right.
He knows that's not the good one, right?
He knows. Yes. Yes, he does.